This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
We're going to Terry Collinsworth, director of the International Labor Rights Fund, an African coca picked by indentured child labor imported into this country, as the United States Customs Service is about to be sued for breaking American trade law. So let's go straight to Terry Collinsworth.
I know that the International Labor Rights Fund is planning to sue the United States Customs Services for breaking American trade law and allowing African cocoa to be picked by indentured child labor. If you could explain more about that, Terry?
Yes. In 1997, Representative Bernie Sanders, who's on our board and who worked with us on this, got an amendment passed to the Section 307 of the Trade Act of 1930 that clarified that there is an import ban on products made with prison labor and slave labor, and he clarified that that includes forced or indentured child labor. That law went into effect at the end of October 1997, and pretty much since then we've been in an ongoing battle with the Customs Service to get them to implement this law. I imagine that they've got quite a few people in the, at that time, the Treasury Department, who are dyed-in-the-wool free traders, who are just absolutely offended at the notion that there would be any substantive import restrictions. But we think that you should be able to at least agree that products made with child slaves would be an exception to a normal free trade policy. And in fact, Congress did pass that law. So our initial effort here will be to go to court under the Administrative Procedure Act, which allows us to ask a court to order an administrative agency to implement a law as required by Congress.
Terry, just to give some meat, some background, a human face to this issue of indentured or slave labor of children, and I understand it's primarily from the Ivory Coast, who are used to produce the chocolate from
Yes.
the cocoa. If you could tell us more about what actually is happening there and what the conditions are.
Sure. The cocoa plantations are in the Ivory Coast, Côte d'Ivoire, and they require seasonal labor, lots of hands picking the cocoa beans. And for years, it's absolutely not disputed that children from neighboring countries, particularly Mali, are trafficked in by labor brokers who, as is true almost everywhere in the world where you have this kind of condition, the labor brokers misrepresent to the families exactly what will happen. They promise money. They promise that the kids will send home money. So these parents who are desperate for any source of income say, okay, they send their kids off with a labor broker with a promise of a good job in Côte d'Ivoire picking cocoa, and the kids disappear then in Ivory Coast. And very much like illegal immigrant labor here in the United States, although the conditions are much worse in the Ivory Coast, the kids then have no legal rights. They can't complain about anything. They don't even, you know who to call. There's no social infrastructure there for them to try to get help from. So they are purely, in any sense of the word, slaves at the mercy of these labor brokers, who then go to, you know, some of the flagship brands of the global economy. We've got Nestle. We've got Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland. Those are the three really big processors of cocoa beans in Côte d'Ivoire. And they employ these children to pick the cocoa. There's no question that this is going on, and there's no question that these companies know that it's going on. And the issue then is what processes are going to be used to stop this practice and what table.
Before we get into that, could you flesh out a little bit more the conditions under which these children work and about how many people are we talking about?
The conditions the kids work under are, as you might be able to picture, it's a very hot place. The food and water are provided by the labor brokers who have essentially stolen these kids, so it's very poor food. Kids get sick. They're beaten if they don't work. They're very much under the control of these labor brokers, and there's no resistant force. No one is there to see if things are safe or if the kids are well fed. And it is a problem that affects somewhere near 15,000 people a year. That's a rough estimate of how many people are trafficked in to pick these cocoa beans.
Terry, how old are these children?
you know, I wouldn't like to say at the outset that even if the kids were 25 years old, that it is still slavery, but it makes it worse when they are children. And the estimates are ranging from about 10 to 16 of the children who are working in these plantations.
And what are they paid, roughly?
Well, most of them are paid nothing.
Literally nothing.
Literally nothing. That the labor brokers are misrepresenting to their families initially that they will be paid, that they'll send money home. And then once they bring them into Cote d'Ivoire, where the kids have no rights, they're illegal there, they're essentially working for the bad food and water that they get.
Is this a condition that only occurs in the Ivory Coast, or are there other parts of Africa or other parts of the world, indeed, that these kind of conditions occur?
There are several places where conditions are this bad. We've previously asked the Customs Service to take a look at the carpet industry in South Asia, for example, where in India, Pakistan, and to a lesser degree, but still existing in Nepal, hand-knotted carpets are made by child slaves who are likewise sold into labor by their families through a labor broker. It's a very similar system. And there is a program out there now called Rugmark, which provides certification and monitoring to identify factories that aren't using slave child labor. But it's still a very, very serious problem. And once again, the Customs Department did not do much at all, if anything, to address these very valid complaints about child slavery in that industry. There are some instances of child labor in the coffee plantations in East Africa, and a lot of this type of labor exists in farm sectors that are more of the informal sector, where there's no exporting or importing going on. So it's harder for us to have a tool to use there.
Terry, tell us when approximately the suit that the International Labor Rights Fund plans to commence will indeed be filed, and what the specific relief is that you seek.
It's essentially done. We're fine-tuning it a little bit and making some decisions about who the other plaintiffs will be, but we will file it by the end of next week. And the relief we're asking for is primarily declaratory and injunctive relief from the court, ordering the Customs Department to implement Section 307 of the Trade Act and ordering the Customs Service to initiate an investigation following our petition with information about the child slavery in the cocoa sector.
What's been the response by the industry about this?
This problem of child slavery in the cocoa sector was identified in mainstream media reports going back several years, certainly by the year 2000. You know, I recall there was a very fine article in the Financial Times about this, and it began a pressure on the industry to do something to take action. They, as is classic in these cases, I see always a three-step process that major industries go through when they are busted for blatant human rights violations such as child slavery. First, there's denial. They go through, and this is what happened here. The industry was like, we don't do that. We would never do that. And then the media picks up on this, and there's more reports, more exposing, and then quickly, the industry needs a public relations exercise, some kind of band-aid to put on this, and this is the phase they're in now. They are in the process of forming an initiative that is essentially setting up an NGO in Geneva to try to address the child slavery situation in Cote d'Ivoire. And they've got a couple of NGOs that are claiming to be participating in this and the cocoa industry. And so they've essentially said, well, we're working on this. What are you worried about? We're working on this. And they're doing this in Geneva, which is probably one of the most polar opposite places of what you would find in Cote d'Ivoire right now. But what really accelerated the process for us is that we sent an investigator again about 3 weeks ago to Cote d'Ivoire to see if there had been any change on the ground in Cote d'Ivoire, because the industry is sitting in Geneva saying, we're working on this. And there was some, you know, excuse making going on that, well, we really can't do much in Cote d'Ivoire because there's a civil conflict going on. They were still managing to get their cocoa in and, you know, out of there on time, no problems there, but they claimed not to be able to go in and look at this problem of child slavery because of the civil conflict. So we finally said, well, let's see what we'll find out again. So we sent our investigator in there, and, you know, sure enough, he showed up at some plantations, and there were kids everywhere. And that just completely outraged us, that there's nothing that has changed on the ground after essentially 2 to 3 years of discussions by the industry and promises to do something about it. So if we leave them to their timetable, their discussions in Geneva will go on in perpetuity while they're claiming to be working on it, and they're clearly not concerned about the kids who are currently today still working as slaves, picking cocoa for them, the companies.
I know there's another campaign that the International Labor Rights Fund is working around, and that has to do with the Unocal Corporation and forced labor in Burma. Why don't you enlighten us as to what exactly is happening with the issue of forced labor constructing a natural gas pipeline in that area of the world and the work of the International Labor Rights Fund relative thereto?
Yes, thank you. That's a very important parallel that, again, all of the world was aware that forced labor was a very serious problem in Burma. The military regime there, if there's any kind of hard labor construction project to perform, the military shows up in villages with guns and makes people come to work as forced laborers for whatever period of time the military determines. And they also use villagers to be porters for the military, to carry their equipment, their ammunition, food, and so on. And they use villagers routinely to be human minefields, that when the military is performing some kind of work for anyone, they make the villagers that they've conscripted walk first down the path in the event that there are landmines or other booby traps for them. So in 1992, in November of 1992, when the whole world was aware of what kind of regime this was, Unocal Corporation decided to enter into a joint venture with the military regime to construct a gas pipeline that would transport natural gas that had been found in the Andaman Sea across a section of Burma to Thailand, where the gas would be sold to the Thai government. And once again, as in the cocoa sector, when Unocal was exposed as having participated in a joint venture with this brutal military regime, their first instinct was denial. They were denying that there would be any forced labor. They were claiming that they had somehow managed to break the bad habit of this regime, and that this was going to be a model project that benefited everyone. They repeatedly got busted for using forced labor. There were reports coming out of people escaping into Thailand to escape from the forced labor they were doing on this pipeline project. Unocal hired a couple of consultants, both when they started the project and mid-project, to give them an evaluation of what was going on. And in very explicit terms, Unocal was told that there was forced labor on the pipeline, and in one case, the consultant reported that the villagers who had complained about the forced labor were summarily executed. Now, Unocal obviously didn't release those to the press. They buried those reports, but we started a lawsuit against them in 1996 after all efforts at discussion and negotiation had been rebuffed by the company. They felt that they were unaccountable to anyone. They didn't feel that there was a way they could be sued, I imagine. So we initiated this case in 1996 to, on behalf of some of the victims of this forced slave labor, and I'm happy to say that after every kind of procedural delay that big corporations and large law firms can imagine, and they, I assure you, they did them all in this case, we're about to go to trial on July 21st to let a jury decide exactly what is the extent of Unocal's culpability in this situation. On a parallel track, we have a second case against Unocal in the federal court system based on the Alien Tort Claims Act, and we have an argument on June 17th in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, primarily to review a technical question of the choice of law that one looks to under the Alien Tort Claims Act. But we're hoping for a clarification about the standards of liability for companies and other individuals for human rights violations.
Well, I think for a non-lawyer, you'll have to explain what the Alien Tort Claim Act is and how that comes into this.
Yes. The Alien Tort Claims Act was passed in 1789 by the very first Congress, the same people who brought you the Constitution, and they, in very clear simple language, provided for a right to sue in federal court for aliens who allege a violation of the Law of Nations. Now, the Law of Nations is a term of art that generally is understood to mean the community of nations' sense of law, that where there is a universally accepted legal standard internationally, that is the Law of Nations. And at this time in the evolution of law, there's general agreement that the Law of Nations includes a prohibition on genocide, torture, summary execution, slavery, crimes against humanity, and unlawful detention. Now, I have to stress that, you know, this isn't a minimum wage violation we're talking about here. In order to get into court, you have to have these extreme conditions of human rights violations. And to me, the most incredible thing going on right now is that, first of all, the corporate community has banded together to fight the application of this law. They are outraged that someone might hold them accountable for torture, slavery, or genocide, or summary execution. And to me, that is astounding, because it seems clear that any company doing business in the world, in the global economy, ought to be able to take an oath that says, we are confident that no part of our business is involved in slavery, torture, summary execution, or genocide. But instead of proudly standing up and saying, American companies don't do that, this law will help prevent that from happening in other places in the world, the corporate community is banding together to attack the application of this law to corporations. There are a couple of business lobbying groups that have filed briefs or attempted to file briefs against us in the Unocal case in the Ninth Circuit, and these include the U.S. Council for International Business, the Washington Legal Foundation, USA Engage, the National Foreign Trade Council, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. These bastions of our corporate values find themselves unable to agree that corporations ought to be prohibited from engaging in slavery, torture, summary execution. That is an astounding proposition to me. But to top it off, a few weeks ago, the Bush administration filed a brief against us in the Unocal case in the Ninth Circuit, also taking the position that this law should not be used in these type of situations. So we have corporate America and the government of America joining together to say that corporations ought to be immune from law that would prohibit them from engaging in these extreme violations.
Well, since you mentioned corporations and the Alien Tort Claim Act, let's go to one of our favorite corporations, ExxonMobil, who, of course, there's been tremendous instances of genocide and murder and torture in Aceh, Indonesia. What is the reality, or how does this apply to a company like ExxonMobil, who really, at least, minimally, never used its power over the security forces there to demand that human rights violations against the local population be stopped?
Yes, absolutely. The ExxonMobil situation in Aceh is very similar to the Unocal situation in Burma, in that Exxon essentially has hired and privatized a couple of battalions of the Indonesian military to protect its vast natural gas fields and facilities in Aceh, Indonesia. And they pay for that service. They are directing that service, and they provide infrastructure and facilities for these military battalions. I have filed a case against them about 2 years ago on behalf of villagers who live around this natural gas facility in Lux Maui, Aceh, Indonesia. And they allege that they were tortured. A few of them are representing their husbands who were murdered by these troops, who basically have a scorched earth policy that anybody who goes anywhere near this thing is fair game to kill or torture in order to keep the villagers terrorized and appropriately distant from these gas fields. The company, throughout the last couple of years, there is a civil war going on in another part of Aceh there, so the company has repeatedly asked for more security. They've gotten that from the government, and despite demands from human rights groups around the world, Exxon has not once placed any conditions on the behavior of those military security forces. They seem perfectly satisfied that as long as these military are protecting their valuable gas fields, it doesn't matter to Exxon that villagers are being killed in the neighborhood. In fact, Exxon is now taken to saying things like, well, we built a school or we built a hospital in that area. Why aren't you satisfied that we're model corporate citizens here? And that is just an insult to the people of Aceh, most of whom don't have access to whatever facilities Exxon has provided. But that certainly is not their consent to being brutalized by ExxonMobil's security forces. And once again, in the Exxon case, the Bush administration is trying to rescue them from the lawsuit. We have sued Exxon for genocide, torture, and summary execution in relation to this project in Aceh, Indonesia. And the Bush administration, through the State Department, wrote a letter to the judge in the case asking the judge to dismiss the case, primarily arguing that it is a vital role of U.S. foreign policy to promote U.S. businesses abroad and that this might somehow interfere with that effort.
Harry, I know that you also have a suit against the Coca-Cola company for its involvement with the murder of unionists in Colombia. Is that also under the same alien tort law?
Yes, it is. We have, in fact, now three cases that result from violence occurring in Colombia, and filed as Coca-Cola. And we have since filed a case against Drummond Coal and most recently Occidental Petroleum. In the first two of those cases, Coca-Cola and Drummond, we allege that these companies are using the paramilitaries in Colombia to murder and torture trade union leaders in order to discourage those unions from forming or from operating in the company's facilities. And the evidence in these cases is particularly strong. We have managers of Coca-Cola bottling plants bringing paramilitaries into the plants and threatening the workers that if they continued to join or participate in a union, that the paramilitaries would come back. In one case in Carepa, Colombia, the paramilitaries were brought in by the plant manager of the Coca-Cola bottling plant, and he specifically threatened that the paramilitaries would be back if the union activities continued. The union did continue its activities, and as promised, the paramilitaries came back and murdered inside the bottling plant the leader of that union. His name was Isidro Hill. And then after murdering the leader of the union, the paramilitaries, along with the Coca-Cola bottling plant manager, passed out union resignation forms to all of the rest of the workers and offering them the choice to resign from the union or to receive another visit from the paramilitaries. So needless to say, all of the remaining workers resigned from the union, and they have managed to do that in a number of other locations. This is, in Colombia, a serious problem because the paramilitaries, even the Bush administration, has called them a terrorist organization. In December of 2001, they were added to the select list of terrorist organizations, the Colombian paramilitary referred to as the AUC. And even after that, these companies continue to have a relationship with the paramilitaries, and according to Colombia human rights organizations on the ground, multinationals, U.S. and European, are the second largest source of support for this terrorist organization, the AUC, after drug revenues. And we have asked the Bush administration to look into whether these companies should be prosecuted for violating the prohibition on giving material support to terrorist organizations.
Terry, as we wind up this segment, the Alien Tort Claim Act cases brought by the International Labor Rights Fund and other highlighted cases that or causes of action that you have related to us, how does this really relate to an impact on the crisis of enforcement of human rights standards? What are the implications and what are the next steps?
Yes, thank you. The most important concept right now, I think, is that the U.S. is off fighting a war on terror using violence. And I won't express here whether that is or is not appropriate, but the fact is that it's not a sustainable approach, that the only way to have an effective, long-term, sustainable approach to terror is to develop a strong, enforceable rule of law system where people who commit acts of terror can be brought to court. We can't invade every single time somebody violates human rights. We need a rule of law system. This Alien Tort Claims Act has been around since 1789. It has been dormant for quite a while. But when it was revived in the late 1970s as a human rights tool, some of the world's worst despots were brought to trial under this law, including Ferdinand Marcos when he fled the Philippines and a number of the Bosnian Serbs. They were butchers. And some of the Rwandan massacres, the leaders of those were brought to trial under the Alien Tort Claims Act. So we have this wonderful tool, and it is a way to encourage the rule of law and respect for the rule of law in the global community. Now, the Bush administration seems to be in just a continuous contradiction on this point, that they're on the one hand saying, we want the world's support and we want our allies to help us with a war on terror, but they're taking a very unilateral approach and aggressively disregarding international law. They backed away from the International Criminal Court Treaty that the Clinton administration had signed, for example. But now to have them attacking the Alien Tort Claims Act, which is the only remaining tool where we can incorporate international human rights law principles into our legal system and develop a healthy respect for international law and to provide a forum for some of the victims of violence in the world, that basically is sending the message to the world that the only remedy that the Bush administration values or respects is violence. And I think that, you know, my 6- and 8-year-old children would understand what we tell them constantly, and that is that violence begets violence. You can't rely on violence to develop a human rights policy. So we're hopeful that this is a temporary aberration of an administration that does not seem to respect the rule of law or the law of nations, and that we'll be able to sustain this process despite the Bush administration's hostility towards it.
Terry Collinsworth, Director of the International Labor Rights Fund. It is always informative and very good to speak to you as we understand the efforts of your organization to fight against the abuses that you have been relating to us in the past half hour.
Well, thank you. It's always my pleasure to be able to talk to you and to share with your listeners the work that we're doing. And, of course, if anyone wants more information, we have an effective website that is www.laborrights, one word, laborright.org.
And this has been Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg for Building Bridges, your community and labor report. Keep struggling.